Hello and welcome to the course on Critical Theory, Cultural Studies, and Postmodern Theory Considered in Terms of Civil Liberty. I'm Michael Reckenwald for LibertyClassroom.com. I'll be your host and guide for this course. The course might otherwise be called Everything You Ever Wanted to Know About Postmodern Theory or Critical Theory, but we're afraid to ask. You won't be afraid to ask, and you won't be afraid to tell after this course, I assure you. We're going to take a look at these rather amorphous and quite abstruse fields in some cases, and we're going to make sense of them, demystify them, make them clear to you, give you an intelligent way to respond to others who discuss them, but more importantly, give you an intelligent way to think about them and to respond to them yourself when you see their epigons and their ancestors in the current context of our contemporary world. But before we start on the course, I'd like to introduce a few notes about the approach to the course. We're going to treat the fields on their own terms first before engaging in any criticism of them. And this is largely because the fields are often subject to ridicule outside of the academy and sometimes within it, which often reveals a contempt before investigation and doesn't let you really know what these fields and these writers have actually said. And we will try to use the terminology of the writers themselves and translate it into a more common lexicon when appropriate and possible. Now, for those of you at all familiar with critical theory and especially postmodern theory, this is a really tough order because these terms are often very abstruse, and they don't lend themselves to easy translation into common parlance. But I think we do our best here, and I think you'll be able to understand what these terms actually mean. To understand these fields, really one needs to understand their vocabulary. To this end, I will define the terms as we go along, and the course is also accompanied by a glossary linked to the course page. Now, we will primarily treat the founders of these fields and their works and not the epigons to any significant extent because the fields are often defined by these authors and the followers have contributed to the fields largely on the founders' terms, although differences surely exist. And one of the things to know about theory, critical theory or postmodern theory or both, and cultural studies is that every author has to diverge to some extent with their ancestors, with their predecessors, Because if they don't, they haven't said anything new. And saying something new is always a prerequisite to contributing to the fields. We will not engage in any extensive biographies of the writers, although we will discuss them to, a limited extent. Nor in any case in extensive histories of the fields, because we are primarily concerned with the ideas of these thinkers, and we want to avoid ad hominem arguments slipping into the discussion. It's very easy just to dismiss so-and-so because he did this and that and killed his wife and so on and so forth. We want to actually engage with the arguments. Why are we treating these fields in the same course? After all, these are massive discourses on their own, in their own right. Each one of them represents a college course or five in the university. So why are we treating them together? Because although they are distinct, each of these fields is a cognate of the others. They're very closely related, although divergent in many ways, as I'll explain. Where they differ, they often do so self-consciously and deliberately. So many times these are responses to previous theories that have been posited by other thinkers, and they know what they're doing in terms of how they're differing with their forebears. Many of these thinkers have been considered with reference to each other. That is, they're often written about at the same time by authors that have followed. So they're not like total strangers to each other. They're very much kin, in effect. The fields are often taught to the same students in the same departments of the academy, which is another good reason to look at them at the same time or under the same rubric. They have combined the three fields to effect a sea change in the academy that's almost inscrutable and ineffable to really pin down. They have had also a significant impact on culture, society, politics, I should add, and the intellectual world in which we live, as we shall see. Now, I'm dividing these two fields roughly into two types, although, of course, this could be quibbled with. I think that it is arguable to do so. And these two types are neo-Marxism and post-Marxism. Neo-Marxism means that the writers hold to Marxist tenets basically, but make modifications of it. They add things to it. They add theoretical or auxiliary arguments or clauses or different areas of research and thinking, but they remain effectively Marxists. The post-Marxists break with Marxism, but it is Marxism from which they break, and we can see the marks of that break in their writing. So I think this is a very clean way of understanding these fields, to divide them into two types, neo-Marxism and post-Marxism. Now, the Frankfurt School of Critical Theory, which is the critical theory component of the course, and cultural studies, the cultural studies component, can be understood as neo-Marxists. Now, Stuart Hall, a co-founder of cultural studies, claimed to be a post-Marxist, but I think it's very arguable that he was still working within and trying to work out problems with the Marxist paradigm. So I consider him a neo-Marxist, and aversions to the contrary. The postmodern theory is the post-Marxist element of the course, and this is a discontinuous and disparate body of theory sharing some features, and they are skepticism, rejection of totalizing theories, rejection of meta-narratives, and a troubling, if not a rejection, of the idea of objective truth. Postmodern theory now can be broken into several sub-schools. Post-structuralism is one. And the way to define post-structuralism briefly, and I go into this much further when we get to it, it's the refusal of universal structures, theories, and systems, the refusal of believing in them, of buying into them, and writing about them as such. So they refuse universal structures, theories, and systems. This is social systems, universal structures of explanation, where that universal structures exist, and so on and so forth. Now, all these theories are philosophical, sociological, and psychological and social science based theory. So we're not talking about the stars or the chemicals. We're talking about the social body generally. One other subfield, and I consider this a subfield of post-structuralism, is deconstruction. And just a shorthand definition for now, it is the demonstration of how language constructs reality. It is not the taking apart of texts. It is a demonstration of how the texts supposedly deconstruct themselves. Psychoanalytic theory is one of the other subschools of postmodern theory, and this is the study of psychodynamic development, etc., the psychodynamic conflicts and resolutions or attempts at resolutions of the individual in context of the social. Semiotics is another subfield of postmodern theory. It is the study of sign systems, and it plays a pivotal role, especially in deconstruction, as we shall see when we get to a discussion of Jacques Derrida. So some timelines for these schools. The Frankfurt School of Critical Theory began in 1923 in Frankfurt, Germany, at Goethe University, as the School of Social Research, Cultural studies began in the mid-50s as a practice, but it wasn't established as an actual field until 1964. Postmodern theory is not like the other two. They are not theorists who self-identified as postmodern theorists. It's a post-hoc construction of others. But I'm dating the beginning to 1968 for reasons I'll give later. The Frankfurt School of Critical Theory. As I said, it began as the Institute for Social Research, founded in 1923 in Frankfurt, and it was housed at Goethe University in Frankfurt. With the rise of Nazi Germany in the 30s, many of the theorists from the Frankfurt School emigrated to the United States in 1933. They stopped off at Geneva, I think, on the way, but they eventually arrived here and finally reestablished themselves at Columbia University in 1934 under the aegis of the sociology department there. It's a very interesting history, but we're not going to go into it too much in terms of why did Columbia accept them, why did Columbia want them, why did they want to be at Columbia. This is a long story, so I won't go into that too much. Cultural Studies was founded as the Center for Contemporary Cultural Studies, or CCCS, at the University of Birmingham in the UK in 1964. And then it emigrated to the United States and elsewhere by the late 70s, such that it is actually the only of these three fields that is a study as such in contemporary universities. There are schools, interdisciplinary concentrations, departments, sub-departments called cultural studies all over the United States and the world at large. And that's not so for critical theory and postmodern theory. These two fields are actually sources for cultural studies as it is right now. Cultural studies delves into and borrows from critical theory and postmodern theory, but it started out as a distinct body of work. I'm dating postmodern theory, its inception, to the publication of Jacques Derrida's Of Grammatology in 1967, and this is a book that we will look at quite a bit of depth, if there is such a thing in postmodern theory, which I'll explain later. But technically, postmodernism as such wasn't named as a way of thinking or a kind of school of thought until the publication of Jean-François Lyotard's The Postmodern Condition, A Report on Knowledge in 1979, another book we will treat. Now, one way of understanding the fields is in terms of the problems they have with or for Marxism, the problems they have with it and the problems they pose for it. This varies in terms of neo-Marxism and post-Marxism and in terms of the schools of thought within them. I'm going to do an overview of the problems with and for Marxism that the schools posed. The neo-Marxist schools have problems with or pose problems for Marxism. One of the main ones is the economic determinism of Orthodox Marxism. Orthodox Marxism was, as propounded by Marx and Engels, was a very deterministic outlook regarding the development of one economic system from another. In the case of Marx and Engels, it's mostly concerned with the development of socialism from capitalism and with the history, with history itself. History is seen as a determined, an economically determined development based on the economic base, the economic social production, relations of production within the society. The economy was seen as driving history and as the motor of history, if you will. There's also connected to this problem of determinism, which I'll talk about at greater length later, is this problem with what is known as the base superstructure of model of Marxism. Marxism conceived of society as basically divided into two major parts. The base, which is the economic structure that is determining of the superstructure, which is everything but the base. The base is the economy. The superstructure includes culture, law, philosophy, ideology, basically everything that is not the intrinsic economic is not involved in the intrinsic economic operations of society. So ideas were conceived of as superstructural ideologies, religions, philosophies, the legal system, etc., etc. These posed a problem for Marxists, for the neo-Marxist schools in particular. Why? Because things didn't work out as planned, according to Marx. That is, it didn't. The working class did not emerge and necessarily undertake a revolution to overthrow capitalism. This became a problem, especially after the Soviet Union was established and the rest of the world failed to follow. So it looked as if this determinism was mistaken. So they had to explain why it hadn't happened, first of all, and secondly, how it could happen, and why it should still happen, but how to bring it about. And that is one of the tasks that the neo-Marxists set for themselves, the main task. Another major problem that was posed for Marxism was the revelations from the Soviet Union of the horrors that were undertaken under Joseph Stalin. This was revealed in Khrushchev's so-called secret speech in 1956, which wasn't so secret and actually spread out into, you know, disseminated broadly in the West and really shook up Western Marxists all over the world. In Europe and the United States, particularly, because, you know, these were horrendous eventualities that really were quite unexpected and revealed what some people had suspected, that the Soviet Union had established itself using repression and using a great deal of force. There were not only the slaughter of the kulaks and others, there was the purges, there was the gulag system, there were political assassinations, and so on and so forth. And a second and related development was the quashing by the Soviet Union of the Hungarian Rebellion, also in 1956. So this looked like, rather than liberating the working class, it was actually squashing them. It was actually crushing them, particularly in the case of Hungary. So, you know, socialism wasn't looking out to be this liberatory, is how they would put it, liberatory development as promised. Instead, it looked to be totalitarian. And that is how it came to be viewed by many, even Marxist leftists, Western Marxists, I'm sorry. Another problem with or for Marxism was the integration of the working class in the West, especially in the United States, into the system itself. That is, rather than the immiserated, discreetly different, you know, culturally divergent and identifiable working class that Marx had located or thought was the agent of history. We have the integration of the working class in the West, a seeming assimilation into comfortable lives, and not at all apparently about to undertake radical action. In fact, they were called conservative, hopelessly conservative by Marcuse. Herbert Marcuse, who I will discuss at length. There was a related problem of consumerism. This is a problem for Marxism for the same reason as the integration of the working class in Western capitalism was also a problem. That is, it looked as if, rather than being immiserated, as I said, or being the abject outcasts of the social body, the working class was enjoying newfound wealth, rising standards of living, access to commercial goods and entertainment, driving some of the same cars as their bosses, watching and or listening to the same entertainment programs and so on and so forth. This was a problem for Marxism for the same reason that the integration of the working class is a problem. It's not the working class that we that had been sought. It's not the working class that had been promised. And it's not a working class about to rise up and overthrow the system. Another problem, or set of problems, I should say, that the neo-Marxists had with Marxism or for Marxism is the failure to recognize other forms of oppression other than the economic, such as racial, sex, gender, sexuality, and environmental issues, which became very much central to the Frankfurt School in particular, especially the environmental, in some cases racial, they talk about, and gender and sexuality, repression and oppression. They find these to be the excrescences, the outgrowths of capitalism, and totally blame, you know, for which capitalism was completely culpable. So they thought the system itself was producing this oppression. They looked at the Vietnam War. They looked at the emergence of the bomb, the Cold War, and blamed it largely on capitalism, actually. Another problem that the neo-Marxists had with or for Marxism was the effects of bureaucratization and technological domination in both socialist and capitalist societies. Although they mention the socialist societies, it's largely the West and capitalism that they critique, surprise, and they're looking at bureaucratization and technological development as a kind of domination over over humanity and over nature as well. We'll go into that in further depth when we get into the Frankfurt School. Now, the post-Marxists have different problems and pose different problems for Marxism. They have different problems with it, and in many cases they simply abandoned it. But their abandonment was self-conscious and deliberate. One way to understand this this abandonment of Marxism, although I still think they are cultural Marxists, broadly speaking, is in terms of the fact that they're inheritors of the legacies of the counter-enlightenment in philosophy, which largely began and grew in Germany from the late 18th century on with the emergence of philosophers like Immanuel Kant and Johann Fichte and Hegel and on and on. There was a debunking of reason as the central faculty for cognition and knowledge, and empiricism or observation as the one of the primary means by which we learn and know, by which we gain knowledge about the world. These were both debunked, or I should say they were attacked by the counter-Enlightenment as not being everything they were cracked up to be by the Enlightenment thinkers. We'll go into that further when we get deeper into the course. Another problem posed for Marxism and another legacy of the counter-Enlightenment is the denial of individual autonomy and agency. This idea that the person or the subject is an autonomous, singular agent who acts out of their own volition and will and reason and so forth. This is all troubled to a great extent by the counter-Enlightenment, and it's much more troubled further by the postmodern theorists. They break down the so-called autonomy of the individual and its individual agency and ascribe this agency to other things, and in fact, in some cases, deny the individual as such, as we shall see. Another legacy of the Counter-Enlightenment was the Counter-Enlightenment's emphasis that it put on the existence of the irrational and the absurd, that the predicament of humanity was not one of something that you could solve with reason, but it was actually an irrational and absurd predicament, and therefore action and thought that didn't begin with the premise of rationality seemed to be apropos to the situation. And we can see this in various philosophers, Friedrich Nietzsche, Soren Kierkegaard, to a much less extent, Kant. This existence of the irrational and emphasis on the irrational and the absurd is definitely picked up by postmodern theorists, as we will see. Another problem for Marxism or with it is the problem with the concept of the totality and totalizing theories in general. Marxism had presumed to treat the whole totality of the social body in all of its parts, and to understand this totality, be able to grasp it and be able to represent it and to be able to offer theories and solutions for what ailed this totality. Well, this is basically, this is rejected. The idea of the totality is rejected by postmodern theorists for the most part, in fact, totally. And they reject totalizing theories like Marxism itself. They think such totalizing theories actually preclude the treatment of other things in the social body. And they also don't believe the totality can be grasped as such, that it may not exist, in fact, that it might be just an abstraction that is not real in the sense that the Marxists posited it as. And related to the idea of the problem with the totality is the problem with master narratives. And this comes into play especially in the writing of Lyotard, who I mentioned. Master narratives are thoroughgoing narratives that explain history and its development and all the actors within it. Marxism was a classic master narrative because it described history as the history of class struggle, and it explained how history developed and basically how everything developed from the economic base, and how everything would play out in the future based on the economic base and the relations of production, as I'll discuss later. Master narratives are explicitly rejected by postmodern theorists as both wrong, but also totalizing, and also, in effect, totalitarian even, because they preclude so much, according to the postmodern theorists. They preclude the examination of other things, and they are presumptuous to be able to suggest that they're able to understand the totality and that they can understand the master narrative of history, like Marxism, or another one which they've long ago rejected would be Christianity. Christianity is a master narrative. They reject the teleology of these master narratives, that is, the fact that they posit an end. They reject the progress narratives of these master narratives, that is, that there's a movement through time and that it's moving toward a particular end, and that what we're looking at in history are stages toward that end. This is all soundly rejected. The postmodern theorists also were shaken up by the revelations from the Soviet Union. Despite their theoretical break with Marxism, in many ways they might be said to be operating under, nevertheless, the ethos of Marxism. And that is to say, they accept the idea of power relations and oppression and underdogs versus the powerful. They just see it in many different multifaceted ways, which can't be completely understood as a whole, but are sub-discourses, as they would call it in Foucault's case. They're discourses that produce, that are the productions of and that produce power and that oppress and that repress. Well, the revelations from the Soviet Union really had a great deal to do with some of the developments of postmodern theory because, again, it was very, they were very disillusioned to find out what had happened in the Soviet Union. And, you know, in many cases, these thinkers were Marxists at some point. If not Marxists in a strict sense, at least in terms of the ethos of Marxism, that is the idea of overcoming the powerful, overcoming the oppressor. So the revelations from the Soviet Union shook up these thinkers as well. And then there was the failure of the 1968 student rebellion in Europe, which was especially focused in France and in France, Paris, France. The students, aligned with some utility workers and unions, as we would call them in the United States, attempted to overthrow what they saw as the various ways that society, what the social order was alienating and excluding them from the production of the social realm, from some social reality. They had really nebulous demands in some cases and nebulous goals. In fact, one of the goals was demand the impossible, which seems to be a self-refuting demand. But that's what they demanded, and it didn't work. They didn't overthrow de Gaulle. They did not take over France, and the system did not topple. And so this was another disappointment. And it ends up being a disappointment for Marxism because even though these students weren't explicitly Marxists as such, there's still the ethos there of Marxism. They were disillusioned by this failure. And I think some of the impetus for postmodern theory can be ascribed to this disillusionment. Now there are new approaches based on the problems that these thinkers found with or for Marxism. And they differ again according to these various, to these two major subdivisions here of neo-Marxism and post-Marxism. So, new approaches that are taken based on the problems. One of the new approaches for the neo-Marxists was to put Hegel back into Marx, to restore the dialectic of history. Now, Hegel's dialectic is a theory of history that posits that history develops by virtue of the resolution of contradictions. You have a thesis and you have an antithesis, and this conflict between the thesis and antithesis produces a third term called the synthesis, which is the resolution of that conflict. And history moves along by virtue of a series of conflict resolutions or resolutions of contradictions, as Hegel and Marx both call them. So, one of the problems, as I said, with Marxism for the neo-Marxists was their economic determinism. To put Hegel's dialectic back into history is to put emphasis on the subject of history, the agent, rather than looking at the working class as a mere object within the system that inevitably leads to Marxism or socialism, I should say. They want to emphasize the subjective element again, more than even Marx did, I suppose. So to do so, they restore Hegel's dialectical method, and I will talk about that further. Another thing they undertook was a critique of culture, and this wasn't, to this point in history, wasn't an undertaking of Marxism, was not a concern of Marxists to critique culture because culture was deemed an epiphenomenon of the economic base. And it was not, it did not have any power to intervene or do anything with reference to that economic base. Well, this starts to be rethought, especially because the determinism, things didn't work out as predicted according to the deterministic model. So they started to think that other things might be at play, like culture. That culture could have an actual effect, not just be an effect, but actually be an intervening, have a certain agency in terms of the social body and the organization of it. So they started to turn towards culture, to critique culture, to see how culture was reproducing capitalism, in effect. And so this is new with the Frankfurt School, and it's become common after them. There was also a critique of social factors, like the family. In particular, the family was seen by Frankfurt School theorists as authoritarian, and perhaps this was why the workers were so docile and unwilling to engage in revolutionary activity. It was the authoritarian family that had stamped their personalities to in such a way that they became conformists. And then there was the system of education, which was also deemed to be authoritarian. And this was taken over in Hungary by one of the precursors of the Frankfurt School, Lukács, and I'll discuss that further later. Another critique was of psychological factors, which is just a more, individualistic approach to the social problems. They thought that the development, the psychodynamic development of the individual was accounting for, again, their docility, their complicity with the system, and so on and so forth. Now with the post-Marxists, they take a new approach entirely, and one of them was a new focus on language, and this comes into play with reference to deconstruction, post-structuralism, and semiotics, fields that I discuss further down the line. But language is now seen to be more than just a way of describing the world, but it's actually, in deconstruction, it is what produces the real, or being, as Derrida put it, is a production of language. It's all based on language. Language is its source. Post-structuralism focuses on this to an extent, more broadly speaking, and semiotics definitely does, and deconstruction borrows greatly from semiotics, as we'll talk about when we get to that. There were new approaches to the subject, that is, the individual. The subject is seen differently. It's deconstructed, if you will. It's seen not as this, solitary, singular, volitional agent who acts of its own accord, but rather as something that's constructed by the social order. It's socially constructed. It's written in post-structuralism and deconstruction. It's written on by the social body. It's kind of a palimpsest on which the social order writes, if you will. And this is prominent in two scholars. One is probably considered a precursor to post-structuralism, but I really rank him as one of them, and that's Roland Barthes. And it's also seen in Michel Foucault, and I'm going to talk about essays by each of these writers that really gets to the heart of their idea about the subject. And they're really talking about the author, what is an author, and the death of the author, Foucault and Barthes. But really they also get into what the conception of the post-structuralist conception of the subject is. And we shall talk about that. Another approach of postmodern theory is to counter power. Now, power is seen as a diffuse and local and almost impossible object to even, it's intangible, and it's impossible to really locate almost, except it can be found in discourses, according to Foucault. And it's local, that is, it's found in various different discourses locally, and it's not in any kind of necessarily dialectical relationship with any other discourse. They act almost regionally, if you will. And they are based in institutions and the family and other areas. I say here that what happened was that Foucault stood Nietzsche on his head. And that is because Nietzsche basically posited that the will to power was the basic modus operandus of life. And but Nietzsche embraced this notion of a will to power. Power was something to seize upon, to live fully, to embrace, and to celebrate even. Whereas Foucault stood Nietzsche on his head, and I'm referring to the way it's said that Marx stood Hegel on his head, which I'll talk about later. But he stood Nietzsche on his head in the sense that he does see power as the main primary modus operandus of life, but rather than celebrating it or embracing it, Foucault sees it as something to be opposed, something to be countered. And I'll talk about that when we get into Foucault more deeply. They treated psychology using psychoanalytic theory. And the precursor for this is Jacques Lacan, who basically translated Freud's biologism, as I say, into symbolic terms. And what I mean by this is that his psychoanalysis was based on anatomy at base, that the drama of the individual was really premised on their biological and that biologism, but on their biology, on their anatomy in particular. And I think you know what I mean, that the penis and penis envy and being born a boy or a girl really determines a great deal your psychodynamic development. So Lacan basically took the biologism of Freud and made it symbolic, that this wasn't happening on the level of anatomy. It was happening on the level of images and language. So we'll talk about that further. And then also, I'm just referencing this here, that feminism picked up Lacanian psychoanalysis and ran with it. And I'll talk about that a bit further when I get into post-structuralist thinkers. But that's it for now on that. And finally, a new postmodern approach is really based on this announcement of the postmodern as a break with modernity. That everything that modernity stood for, which was rationality, scientific progress, the development of wealth through capitalism, its mode of production, which was seen as, of course, capitalist accumulation of wealth vis-a-vis exploitation, all these are challenged. And in fact, the postmodern represents a new era, a new epoch. There are new modes of production. There's new knowledge, modes of knowledge production. There's new modes of representation. There's new experiences for the individual. There's not alienation, but a weird kind of what they called a jouissance or joy at being more or less not alienated, but just utterly disabused of a order. And I'll go into that further. But that's it for today's discussion. And so in next class, I'm going to take up the question of the precursors to the Frankfurt School of Critical Theory. We will introduce the precursors and a couple of the main ideas of the Frankfurt School of Critical Theory. Thank you.